darling, clapping.
Hello, welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here as we are here today. We're here today as we're here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. Every day, it's a different co-host. Yesterday, it was Tom McDonald. The day before that, it was not Simca Fisher, but I did have Elizabeth Scalia on. And today, we've got Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett is the author of numerous super interesting books that you should rush out and get because Rod Bennett is a super interesting guy. So he's written Chesterton's America, a distributist history of the United States, and he's written a book called The Christus Experiment that is just this Looney Tunes science fiction adventure. And he's the author of The Apostasy That Wasn't, and most recently he's the author of The Popcorn Cathedral, which is a really interesting look at the intersection of film, faith, and fantasy. He has a healthy human being's love of great fantasy science fiction films, of both good and bad.
Well, let's just say I'd prefer to say that I find the good in even the ones that some people think are bad.
that's to be said. You know, you're a kindred spirit with the great Forrest Ackerman. Forrest Ackerman, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is the guy who essentially invented sci-fi fandom. There were people who wrote science fiction, and there were people who published science fiction, but there was really nobody out there who had a voice for people who just read science fiction and loved it. And until Forrest Ackerman came along, in basically the late 30s and early 40s, he got to be friends with people like Ray Bradbury, among others, and Ray Harryhausen as well, and a whole bunch of other people. And so, you know, the giant sci-fi cons that happen everywhere around the country today, where people go and dress up as their favorite monster or hero, and you have, you know, everybody from, you take it, Star Trek to Buffy the Vampire Slayer to, you know, whatever, showing up at these cons and mixing and mingling with their fans. Forrest Ackerman was basically the guy that invented all of that.
He was indeed.
So it is,
showed up at it is no, the 1939. I don't think our connection is working all that well today, Mark.
I can hear you now. Showed up the 1939.
Am I breaking up or lagging?
You're lagging a little bit, but it's coming through. So he showed up at what?
The 1939 Worldcon, World Science Fiction Convention, dressed as a man from the future. He went to the New York World's Fair that was going on at the same time, also in his cosplay, as they call it nowadays. They had a sort of a Hyde Park speaker's corner at the World's Fair, and he took the microphone when his turn came, dressed as the man from the future, and told everybody that he had just arrived from the year 2039. To see the World's Fair, so
really,
yes, he's the first geeky person ever to dress up in a costume and go out and startle the ordinary people. So
so delightful.
But
delightful,
yeah, he in the early days. That's right. In the early days, he was known as the world's greatest science fiction fan. In fact, you used the term sci-fi. He invented the term sci-fi as a riff on hi-fi, which was big in the 50s. And so he's the actual inventor of the term. Before that, they had various different names that hadn't quite taken off. And he's quite the important figure.
The one I always liked was this is the one C.S. Lewis uses all the time. He uses scientifiction, which doesn't come trippingly to the tongue.
Well, that was the problem with that particular word. Hugo Gernsback coined that term. He was the editor of Amazing Stories, which was the first ever in the late 20s, the first ever magazine devoted solely to science fiction. But yeah, well, I don't think Hugo that one ever took off. That's right. That word never mm-hmm. took off just simply because nobody knew how to pronounce it. So,
right. Sci-fi, or
it might be an unpronounceable word. So,
that's right.
But no, Gernsback was an interesting character too. But just about all of those early sci-fi magazines from the 30s and 40s have a letter in them from Forey Ackerman. So long before he became, well, what he became later was a literary agent for science fiction writers. And then much later, after he'd been very famous in science fiction circles, he founded a movie monster magazine. He had been a movie fan since the 20s and had been collecting movie stills and posters and all other things of that type. And he was approached by a publisher who said, let's publish a magazine with your collection in it. And so that magazine came out in 1958, Famous Monsters of Filmland. Some of you may remember. Okay. If you're anything like me, if you got caught with it in your house, it was worse than getting caught with Playboy. So because at least Playboy didn't suggest that you were mentally defective in some way, but this one did.
Okay. That's really great.
But a whole generation. Go ahead.
There's a fun book that came out a few years ago called "It Came from Bob's Basement."
Right,
Bob Burns. Bob Burns. So Bob Burns was another guy who was he was a kindred spirit with Forey Ackerman, and he actually worked in bad science fiction films in the 1950s. So he was, you know, he was the guy in the big rubber ape suit sometimes, or the robot, or whatever.
Yeah.
But he collected all of this memorabilia, and including, I mean, he has one of the original armature, the skeleton, the metal skeleton that was used. And then later covered over with, you know, padding and cotton and then rabbit fur and so forth for King Kong.
Original stop motion
So he's preserved that. And he also preserved the pterodactyl from King Kong. But he's known by, you know, all these other geeky fans, including some people who are, you know, enormously famous, like Sir Peter Jackson, you know, who actually put him in his remake of King Kong. There's one scene where Kong, you know, when he's loose in Times Square, he chucks a car at somebody. And so there's Bob Burns, you know. And so it's fun because that whole community just sort of grew up. And it's all people who really have nothing in common except we love science fiction, fantasy stories. Whether they're good or not, we don't really care, you know.
Well, Famous Monsters was a touchstone for a whole generation of people. George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, people like that all admit that they were huge fans as teenagers. And so he is sort of an uncle to everybody who makes those kinds of films today. Even though the films are a lot more expensive and elaborate these days, they all have that. In fact, there's a fun story of Bill Clinton went to visit I think it was the other way around. I think Steven Spielberg came to visit Bill Clinton while he was president. So it was a visit at the White House. And they were supposed to talk about Spielberg's Holocaust Memorial Foundation or something. They had a serious agenda. But it didn't take too long before they both realized, a few minutes into the conversation, that they'd both been Famous Monsters readers. And it was it. That was it after that. And so what was supposed to be a 45-minute meeting or something ended up with the two of them in the White House movie room that's got a little movie theater in the basement, and just looking at a lot of their favorite old movies, and they ended up staying up till midnight So talking about old monster movies. So
that is
so yes, Forry Ackerman and Famous Monsters was influential. And I'm one of the victims.
Well, you know, but that's just one of the things I love about you. So, listener, you're probably wondering what this has to do with the Catholic faith. Well, I will tell you, you're going to be surprised because this actually does have something to do with the Catholic faith, which is, among other things, one of the things that Jesus understands about human nature is that there is more than one kind of love. When we English speakers talk about love, we typically mean eros. We mean romantic love. And certainly eros has its place. Everybody loves a love story. But what's interesting is that the kind of love that Jesus particularly depends on as he's gathering his disciples around him is phileo, that is to say, friendship love. And the difference between eros and friendship is that with eros, the lovers are face to face, looking at each other. With phileo, the lovers are side by side, looking at something else. They're friends because, hey, you like monster movies too? I love monster movies. And a friend's movie is born. Connecting the dots. Actually, we're here with Rod Bennett. We'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Shay, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We're struggling a bit with Skype. Skype is acting weird, but that's all right. So I want to say before the break, the difference between eros and phileos is that with friendship, you're standing side by side looking at something else. And that's the essence of friendship. You meet somebody who says, you know, you liked monster movies too? I love monster movies. And a friendship is born. And that's what Jesus does with his disciples. The disciples have nothing in common with each other, practically. What does Simon the Zealot have in common with Matthew the tax collector? Nothing. And a lot of these guys are, you know, they're very different people. Some of them are related to each other, so Peter and Andrew, but or James and John and so forth. But what really marks the disciples out and the particular kind of love that binds them together at first and is really the foundation for the greater, the divine love that will ultimately unite them is friendship. And so it's friends that Jesus sends out into the world as his apostles, not lovers, despite what some whacked out theologians have proposed from time to time. And that's really significant in our tradition, that friendship is a hugely important form of love that is deeply neglected in our culture, especially among men. There's still room in our culture for women to be friends. There's very little room in our culture for men to be friends, and men are starving for friendship as a result. So I mentioned that because there's always this serious subtext to even the lightest conversations. That, you know, when you talk about movie monster fandom, what brings people together at sci-fi cons and forms friendships there is, in this case, a common love of science fiction and fantasy and that sort of thing. Now, some really deep friendships can be formed over such things. So, for example, the Inklings, perhaps one of the most, I think, significant, or if not the most significant literary friendship in the 20th century was a bunch of guys who were brought together in part by their love for fantastic literature of very different kinds. But they had certain things that they deeply believed, and they expressed those things in the form of science fiction and fantasy literature that goes on having an impact even today. And it came out of friendship.
Yep.
So the power of friendship.
I was going to say we owe the what was picked to be the greatest Catholic book of the 20th century, The Lord of the Rings. We owe that to a group of geeks who enjoyed fantasy stories, hanging out once a week and reading their stories to each other. And, you know, and it's a work, monumental work that will only get more important as the years go by.
As time goes by. And what's interesting, it was friendship that really made that book happen. It's not Tolkien's wife who urges him to write. There are moments in literature where it's the spouse who really is the catalyst. So the reason that we have the Sonnets from the Portuguese by Elizabeth Barrett Browning is because her husband said, "You have to publish this." And so she
does. Usually it's the usually it's the wolf at the door that gets things finished, though.
That's very true. But with Tolkien, what really made it happen was Lewis kept saying, "This is great, keep going." And he labored on it for 14 years. He labored on it. And it was Lewis's enthusiastic support. And not all the Inklings were enthusiastically supportive.
Right. And Tolkien himself expressed several times that he didn't really care whether it was ever published or not.
Yeah. But Lewis really, really insisted that this was an important piece of work and kept at him. And, and he'd go and read. And Owen Barfield, another one of the Inklings, would utter a four-letter Anglo-Saxon expression. And say, "Oh no, not more elves." He didn't like it at all, but Lewis loved it, and Lewis was a huge encouragement. And that's another aspect of the special charism that friendship can bring to the mix. And so, friendship has always been crucially important in the Christian tradition. As another species of love that the human race absolutely demands in soul. At one point, Lewis writes in The Four Loves, he says, "If you were given a choice between perfect eros that never dies out, you know, that first initial blush of passion that happens when you first fall in love. If you're given a choice between having that in a relationship for the rest of your life, or the perfect friendship, you know, the really wonder, another mark of friendship that's different from Eros is Eros demands exclusivity. Friendship really, the more the merrier. Four friends are good, six friends are better. And those moments where you've got all of your friends around you and there's a drink at your elbow and the talk is just flowing and everybody's having a marvelous time. He says, if you had a choice between perfect friendship or perfect lifelong eros and you had to choose only one and the other would be gone, he says, which would you choose and which would you not regret having chosen? And he was somebody who was capable of very deep friendships, and he had a lot of them. And I've always thought about that because it's true. I mean, there are people in my life who are just deep, good friends. And I don't know what I would do without those friendships. Those friendships are as important to me in their own way as my marriage is.
It's interesting to add a touch of poignancy to the story. Lewis and Tolkien eventually had, if not a falling out, they got where they couldn't talk very well anymore. And it was almost entirely due to the difference between their Roman Catholic and Protestant religions. I mean, I guess there's differences of opinion on this, but most people feel like that they just had areas that they couldn't, they knew they should be talking about and couldn't. And that it made it put a distance between them. But people who say that it was the friendship was ruined or broken or something like that haven't looked carefully enough, because if you look even late in their time together, even in the late 50s and early 60s, you find them defending each other to editors and, you know, on newspaper letters pages and things like that. They were always quick to stand up and defend the other guy and, you know, pen what were really pretty poignant praises for a man that they hadn't been able to talk to very well for 20 years, probably. So, that does add a touch of poignancy to what you're saying.
Yeah, it is. And it is, it is one of the sadnesses. And, you know, Tolkien writes after Lewis's death, he says that Lewis's death was like an axe blow to the roots. It was very painful for him to lose Lewis because he still loved him, you know, and that's one of the great, you know, hardships that goes with, you know, love in this fallen world. And that also is something that Lewis speaks to. He says, you know, there's a temptation to say, well, if you love at all, then you risk having your heart wrung and possibly broken. But he said, it's either that or you lock your heart away in a casket and there it will stay, you know, warm, airless, and eventually become hard and impenetrable. And so that's your choice. You can either refuse to give your heart, or you can give your heart at the risk of having it broken. That's what our Lord did. This is what we celebrated last week in the Feast of the Sacred Heart. You know, the heart that Jesus offered was run through with a spear. That's what we're called to as Catholics, which is, of course, terrifying. That's how it goes. Hey, I want to throw the phone number out on the off chance that there's somebody listening. I know you're out there because I see the downloads. But give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to join the conversation. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can either call or text us at that number. And you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. So, Rod.
Yes.
The Popcorn Cathedral. We started talking last week. You were talking a bit about the War of the Worlds, but there was a larger point that you were making. Can you recall what you were saying at that point? Oh, we're at a break.
I'll try to remember while Beethoven plays.
Try to bring it back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we'll be back in just a yiffy.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. So, Rod, tell me about another of the pieces that you've written for the Popcorn Cathedral. It's a whole collection of essays. What else is in there?
Well, there's a piece on which I'm not sure if you've heard before or not. I did a piece on called The Gospel According to Frank Capra, which was an analysis of not just It's a Wonderful Life, but lots of other Frank Capra movies. One of my first great non-monstery film loves was It's a Wonderful Life and the Frank Capra movies.
He is my first instructor in Catholic social teaching.
Yeah.
I think a very fine one. Yeah. And I think a very fine one, too.
Yep. Yeah. There's an explicit connection, although I don't bring it out in this particular article, an explicit connection between Capra and G.K. Chesterton.
Okay.
One of Capra's best friends, a man named Miles Connolly, the man that really inspired Capra to start making more heartfelt thematic movies rather than just frothy screwball comedy, had also been the editor of a Catholic magazine in the 20s and was one of both Chesterton and Belloc's American agents. So he bought a lot of articles, Connolly did, from both Capra and Chesterton. And so when Connolly began preaching to his friend Capra at the time had joined the Church of Christian Science because his wife was a member of that group, the Mary Baker Eddy Christian Scientists. Connolly pretty much converted Capra back to the Catholicism of his youth and pretty much turned him on to Chesterton and Belloc. So I was just noticing, had forgotten about it for a long time until today. I was going through some of my old files, and I own a copy of an auction guide for when they auctioned off Capra's library after he passed in the early 90s, and they've got all of the books that Capra owned in his library, and they were put on auction, and a lot of them are Chesterton and Belloc. So he definitely was a disciple, which is why, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Well, there, Chesterton had a Mr. Smith too, as you know very well, Mark.
Indeed. I know him very well.
Yes. And, Miles Connolly was the author of a little book called Mr. Blue, which you may or may not know about, written in the 20s, a kind of a modern St. Francis loose in 20s New York. And it definitely was one of the inspirations for Capra's big hit, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. So all of this Catholic, more than Catholic, Chester Bellockian stuff that people find in Capra's movies is not just a coincidence. It's there because he kind of got steeped in all that stuff by way of his friend Miles Connolly. So,
yeah,
that's a pretty interesting story, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I'm a huge fan of Capra.
The great distributist filmmaker, you might say, it's interesting. Capra gets people can't decide whether Capra is a liberal or a conservative, which is usually a good sign about somebody. People have the same problem with Pope Francis, Pope John Paul II, other people like that. If you baffle both the liberals, if the conservatives think you're too liberal and the liberals think you're too conservative, chances are you're on to something. Not that there's some sort of golden mean between the two, but that you just, you're sort of above their whole left-right paradigm as Pope John Paul II was. So, and Capra falls into that same thing. I've had people, friends of mine, swore up and down that he was a raging liberal, and then other people who said that he was that he was a horrible conservative. So usually a good, when you're talking to somewhat extreme people, this is a good sign. So I'm also pleased to say that that my essay, The Gospel According to Frank Capra, caught the eye of Charles Colson, the famous Christian convert and head of Prison Fellowship a wonderful, wonderful group of people. And he featured it on his Breakpoint program one day. So that was a nice honor.
Really?
And Well, that's good to hear.
So, wow. I want to be the first to ride in your Learjet when you get that. So,
right. Let's see. What else is in the book? I wrote a piece about George Lucas and Star Wars, whether Star Wars is a Eastern plot to, the second coming of the Maharishi Yoga to trick Christian young people into New Agey Eastern religion. I wrote an essay called Mystery in the Wax Museum, which is about how I discovered the Catholic doctrine of the veneration of saints in a corny old historical wax museum in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. I wrote a long and some people think kind of hilarious story about how I overcame heaven and earth to get my videotape recording of The Bride of Frankenstein in the early 80s. It's just quite really? An epic. I also wrote a piece called Why 2001 Won't Be Like 2001, which is about
I take it you wrote that in the 90s?
Yeah, it's about just as John Glenn was about to return to space in 1998. That was interesting meditation about the fact that John Glenn essentially gets to back to space in 2001 or just a few months early. And, you know, there's no Howard Johnsons in space. There's no Pan Am Space Pan Clippers. It's essentially his mission of 1998 was essentially a rerun of his mission of 1962. So I sort of parsed that out a little bit and talk about space movies and how sometimes their predictions are really good and sometimes not very good. Yeah. 2001, one of my favorite movies is a really lousy movie about prophesying the future.
You know, I wrote an essay one time. You might be interested. I don't know if I ever talked about this with you. I wrote a piece. It was after watching 2010. And right. You've told me about it. Oh, okay, yeah. So for the benefit of my readers, Chesterton sets his novel, The Napoleon of Notting Hill, in the year 1984, curiously enough. So he's writing close to the beginning of the 20th century. And he prefaces the book by saying that people love playing this game called Cheat the Prophet. And he says Cheat the Prophet is very simple. Someone comes along and prophesies what's going to be going on in the future, and then people listen to that prophet, and then they go away and do something else. He says it's a simple game for people of simple taste, but
the rules are easy to learn.
Yeah, and so and he was living in a time where people were, including H.G. Wells was just filling the air with prophecies about all this stuff that was going to happen, And Chesterton, being commonsensical, says in 1984, people are going to be pretty much like they are now. And he sets the action of his novel in 1984. So, of course, 1984 is a year that becomes full of ominous portent when George Orwell writes his famous novel, 1984, in which 1984 becomes synonymous for this all-controlling global state and so on and so forth.
Chesterton's book was 30, 40 years before that.
Yeah, Chesterton's book is 30, 40 years before that. So what's interesting then is in 1968, Kubrick makes his famous 2001. And in 1984, the real 1984, a sequel is released to 2001.
Which Kubrick had nothing to do with, by the way.
Kubrick has nothing to do with. And it's called 2010. And it's what's fascinating is that it does all of those things that Chesterton warns about. It has a confident view of the future. Here's what's going to happen, right? So, of course, the Soviet Union is eternal.
Yes.
Will always be here. And so it's there in the film of 2010. And in 2010, the whole action centers around the mysterious reappearance of Dave Bowman, the astronaut who becomes the star child in 2010. And he keeps turning up as this sort of ghostly presence who's, you know, telling people that he knew on Earth that something wonderful is going to happen. And so they send this mission back to Jupiter to find out what happened to Dave Bowman and all of this stuff. And the long and the short of it is that the great, glorious, wonderful thing that's going to happen is that Jupiter is going to, but through the ministrations of the aliens who transformed Dave Bowman into the Star Child, Jupiter will be transformed into a second sun in our solar system, kind of a mini sun. And then the moons of Jupiter become sort of these, we're given a warning by the aliens at the end, don't go to Io. We're not allowed to touch Io because there's some kind of, you know, evolutionary experiment going on Io, thanks to the aliens who are, you know, starting life on Io as a second planet. And so that,
it's,
and so
a, it's this a setup glorious, for the next, it's a setup for the next 2000.
Right. All right. Yeah, well, we're up against the break, but we'll be right back. So there's an interesting punchline to all this. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm this Mark Shea. And we are here with Rod Bennett. We've been talking a little bit before the break about the various train of completely wrong prophetic announcements that have come out, particularly the 20th century. So I'm talking about the odd coincidences of surrounding the year 1984. So Orwell told us that 1984 was going to be this, you know, this monstrous Stalinist despotism and so forth. And when you get to the actual 1984, it's pretty much like the 1984 that Chesterton foresaw, in which everybody's pretty much the same. And so that prophecy is, thanks be to God, proven false. But in the real 1984 itself, a film comes out that's a sequel to 2001, which was itself, you know, a sort of prophetic statement about the destiny of the human race. And 2001, as you mentioned, 2001 didn't turn out at all to be like 2001, the movie. Instead of, you know, humanity evolving into the Star Child under the ministration of the aliens, instead we had the greatest assertion of, you know, Bronze Age backward barbarism in modern history. You know, when a bunch of Bronze Age thugs commandeered the technology invented by 21st century Westerners who were still looking forward to the Pan Am Space Clipper, and flew it into the World Trade Center. And that's what actually happened in 2000. So
I also thought it was rather significant that the owners of 2001 said, hey, it would be great if we released 2001 to the big screen in 2001. We have a big reissue. Yeah. And so they worked to try to get all the rights lined up and get new prints made and all the rest of it. And the movie finally came out in February of 2002. Yes, it hardly seems worth doing at that point, right? And that says something about man's mastery over technology and circumstance.
So anyway, the sequel to 2001, oddly enough, came out in 1984, in the real 1984, and it was 2010. And the big fear in 1984 was global cooling. And the climax of 2010 when in the film 2010, the Soviet Union is going to be here forever. The big fear is global cooling, and the great wonderful thing that happens at the climax of the movie is Jupiter turns into a second sun, and so now we have two suns warming the Earth, and you know the global cooling is solved, and all of this is great. So when you get to the actual 2010, the great fear is global warming. And the last thing that we would ever want would be suddenly to sprout a second star in our sky or a second sun in our sky. End of life on Earth for us. But so anyway, I always thought that was just such an odd confluence of significant dates and false prophecies. So
It's not all that widely known, but as it happens, the movie 2001 is one of Pope John Paul's favorite movies. He listed it always near the top of his list of great films, which is, I think, pretty cool and pretty interesting. Yeah. There's a little bit of an interesting story behind that. Stanley Kubrick was raised a Dutch Calvinist in a home that wasn't very religious, to say the least, and always referred to himself. Yeah, referred to himself as an agnostic all of his life. Sometimes an atheist.
I always thought Kubrick was Jewish. I did not know that.
No. Okay. And absolutely brilliant guy. Absolutely incredible. I mean, he made his living. He made a good adult living from the time he was 14 on and subsidized his hobby in photography by going to Central Park every day and beating grown men out of money playing chess.
Okay.
He made a substantial living doing that. But so he's a brilliant guy. But the interesting thing about Kubrick in 2001 was, as he and Arthur C. Clarke were collaborating on the movie, making the film, the movie 2001 is based to begin with on a little short novella by Clarke called The Sentinel. And essentially just has the idea of the monolith in it, the idea that that this thing has been left behind on Earth to guide human beings to a higher level of development. And the two of them tried to work on the film together, and it seemed like it would be a perfect marriage. But in reality, it actually ended up being a little bumpy because Kubrick may have been an atheist, but he wasn't the village kind, and Arthur Clarke sort of was.
Uh-huh.
And by that, I mean he's a guy who kind of exults in it all and enjoys his atheism, whereas Kubrick was sort of a sad atheist. And the interesting thing is that as it got near the end of making the film, they were trying to decide whether to actually show the being or beings that was responsible for placing the monoliths and that had saved Dave Bowman from his death in space and brought him to limbo in time where he could be moved up to the next ladder rung on the ladder of evolution. Arthur Clarke wanted to say explicitly that it's aliens that are doing it. He said it's aliens, and we need to show the aliens. He wanted to show, in fact, there are drawings that exist of some kind of alien similar to the ones you see at the end of Close Encounters. And Kubrick said, no, you don't want to do that. He said, my whole jumping off point for this movie was that Kubrick, in trying to decide to make a science fiction movie, he said, I'm fascinated by the idea that if you saw a being that was 30 million years ahead of us in development, that it had all the powers and all of the things that we normally would attribute to a god, is there any real reason in making a distinction between a god and an alien?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, whatever word you use, you're talking about the same kind of being. You know, you're talking about a of superior disembodied intelligence, you know, that's so far above us, it's like us above ants, you know. So Kubrick specifically didn't want to show any aliens. He said, if you do that, that makes it too explicit. He said, I want to leave it up to people to decide. And they argued over it, and Kubrick eventually won, as he always did. And Arthur C. Clarke was always disappointed. That's right. Arthur C. Clarke was always disappointed that they had not shown the aliens, because otherwise people will miss the point, right? And after the movie came out, there were lots and lots of people who wrote theories or reviews, letters about what the movie meant. And but Kubrick picked one as his favorite. It was from a 15-year-old American girl, and you can read the essay online. It's absolutely brilliant, where she argues that that God is the one that's putting the monolith there, that essentially that the movie is a movie about how God intervenes in human history to make all this happen. And Kubrick said, this is the best review I've ever read on 2001. And it's the closest he's ever come to explaining what he meant by the film. And and this is one of the reasons I think that Pope John Paul liked the movie so much, that that Kubrick said it's much better if our whole point is what's the difference here, you know, then then let's let it be ambiguous. Let's leave some ambiguity in it. You know, if you just show a guy in a rubber suit, you know, you bring it down.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is that when Kubrick finished 2001, he went on to other things. Well, Arthur C. Clarke wrote other 2001 books, built a whole little mini career out of being the guy who had dreamed up 2001. And when he got a chance, he made himself the auteur behind 2010, the sequel. And this largely explains why 2010 is so different than 2001, why everything is so thuddingly literal, and why he leads you along by the nose from point to point, and why he very explicitly makes it clear that, no, there's not any freaking gods or anything. It's aliens.
Right.
And so this is his revenge. He says, this is how 2001 should have gone.
And of course, I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
Yes. And he finally got to do it his way. And of course, not many people like his version better than Kubrick's.
But, well, you know, it's funny. It is funny because this, you know, this goes to demonstrate something that I've said for a long time, which is that science fiction is obsessed with a kind of creating a secular eschatology, where aliens stand in for God or for angels, where, you know, it's onward and upward. We ascend into heaven, but we do it through rockets, and we, you know, the eschaton is reached by our spreading to the stars and that kind of thing.
Because there's a whole other discussion in there.
Yeah, the human heart demands that kind of transcendence, and if you're not going to get it from Christian tradition, you just make something up. But Rod, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Always lots of fun.
Thank you. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer was Ethan Bull, and I will be back tomorrow with Trisha Bulla. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.